Here on Packet Pusher, sometimes we talk about the bleeding edge or waffle on about the future, but sometimes we like to stand firmly in the hot aisle, screwdriver in hand, laptop at the ready, and get something done. And the Design and Build series is intended to help you do just that. And in this installment, we are talking about security. When it comes to security, we tend to think in terms of firewalls and intrusion prevention appliances and log analyzers and so forth, right? But a lot of that stuff gets expensive. So what sort of security infrastructure could you design and build if you were on a budget? And our guest today has some ideas about that. And before we get to our guest, I thought we'd introduce the Packet Pushers regulars that are here today. First up, Drew Conroy-Murray. Drew, how are you today?
Hi, Ethan. I'm fine and dandy.
That was an unenthusiastic fine and dandy. Come on, man. It's Friday morning. It's the weekend. Looking you in the face.
Right, come on, give it to me. Give me some loving.
Ethan. I'm fine and dandy.
That's the over-the-top radio voice we're looking for right there. And then that, of course, was Mr. Farrow, who is still in the midst of being disrupted.
Yes, I am. Today, I actually have to tear down my old office, and I go to live back on a very dodgy 3G connection for some time. 2 or 3 weeks now, my ISP says. After 8 weeks of talking to them, guess what? I've had some success. This story goes on. I finally found the person who actually manages installations in my region.
You found the right Vogon.
I did.
This whole thing sounds like Vogons to me, you've been submitting paperwork and it's getting rejected. And well, you have to go talk to this office. And well, there's a cabinet at the end of your street, but the cable's not going to make it to your house. And it's just this ongoing saga of Vogonity.
Oh, you have no idea. But you know when you talk to a vendor sales rep and you say, can you do that? And they go, well, I'm sure I can, but it's not me that does it. I'll have to go and talk to somebody else.
Yeah.
and you know that feeling you get right then and there, which is no. What they don't actually want to say is no, but what they really should say is just no, but they don't. But he's the salesperson for the whole region for new builds, and it might take 2 or 3 weeks, but it could take longer.
Uh-huh.
You know what that means, right?
It's going to take longer.
I'm going to be living like a savage, scrounging for free Wi-Fi on the street as I wander from coffee shop to coffee shop.
How are you going to record?
We'll work it out, buddy. We'll work it out.
Oh, boy.
I'll be traveling for a couple of weeks. I'll be in America for 2 weeks.
You're going to the Intel, not the developer forum. What is the event?
Influencers.
Right.
Influencers and Lort Theaters. And we're going to get together and have thoughts and influences. We're going to have buckets of influence handed around. And we're going to dunk our heads in it and see what we look like.
And then Del World in Austin, right?
Yep, and then down to Del World in Austin, which is going to be awesome because I've never been to Del World. Apparently, Del World's like a little place off to the right of Mars where only Texans and Delish people live.
Drew, you're heading to Del World as well, I think, right?
Yes, I will be at Del World.
All right.
Yeah, Greg and I will see what trouble we can cause in Austin, Texas.
And from my travels, I'm heading to the OPNFV Summit. And it looks like we're going to Onoog up in New York City as well for the fall session. So Packet Pusher's on the road over the next month or so.
Yeah, the rock and roll road show. But after that, you can't get me out of my house for nothing, because by then the internet will be in and I'm never leaving again.
There you go. Well, let's move the show along and talk to our guest, Mr. Jay Swan, who's been on the show before. Jay, would you introduce yourself to the Packet Pushers audience?
Yeah, my name is Jay Swan, and I'm happy to be here to talk about security in the small to medium enterprise. I've just left about 11 years in the small to medium enterprise space doing both network engineering in the traditional sense and security. And by the time this show airs, I will be a security engineer at GitHub. So I'm going from the enterprise world to the web world and from networking / security to full-time security. I was on show 192 in 2014 talking about logging, and I'm happy to be back.
You know, Ethan, I've got visions of this person with a big target, like 100 points
exactly
around the outside, 50
of,
points,
yeah.
And then right in the middle is like 1,000 points, instant internet fame, and Jay's wearing that target right on his back.
That's right. That's right.
Working in security at GitHub, that's got to be awesome, right?
Jay's gone from, I was in, you know, the SMB space doing security tasks and so on, and, you know, it wasn't too visible to, I want everyone to shoot at me. Get your biggest weapons and aim from my head, please. Oh, Jay. Security GitHub, man, I am looking forward to reading about your experiences there, whatever it is that they will let you talk about. Speaking of which, there's a lot of things that you want to talk about today. You kind of ran this idea by us in email and were like, ooh, this sounds like a good show. Let's put it together. And I popped into the Google Doc to write some notes and start building an outline. And you had already dumped your brain into this thing. So let's get this show started by asking you, since we couch this show in terms of the small and medium business, why do we want to talk about them specifically? What would you say is different about small and medium enterprise versus other organizations that we might talk about on the show?
Well, let's start by talking about what I mean by small to medium enterprise. And basically, you can say business or enterprise. I think they're somewhat interchangeable, but mostly we're talking about companies that are somewhere in the neighborhood of, let's say, 100 to 2,000 employees, where you're big enough that you have an IT staff, but you're not big enough that you have a dedicated security team. And on the high end of that, you might have maybe one FTE doing security, most often split between several different people. So a lot of places I've seen, there's somebody on the network team who does part of security. There's somebody on the server team who does part of security. You might have somebody working on logging, that sort of thing. And together, maybe they're in the 0 to 1, maybe 2 FTE kind of realm. And what's different about that is that, well, you just don't have a security team. It's hard to do a sort of classic big picture security model that you read about in the books.
Yeah. So I'll just comment on that I've been in that situation where the mantra of the IT manager is something like, well, security is everybody's job. And so we don't have any one person dedicated to security because we're all supposed to be doing it. And so, yeah, the roles and responsibilities of the things that you do specifically related to security get spread around the team. And for me as the network guy, typically my role was all of the security infrastructure, firewalls and intrusion prevention devices and logging and reacting to events and doing some occasionally forensic analysis, these sorts of things. And the app people, of course, had to deal with, you know, user authentication and a lot more of that sort of stuff.
One of the things that you run into in the security world that is kind of a pet peeve of mine is there's a lot of negativity going around. And some of the phrases that you hear are things like, you know, those guys were so dumb that, or they deserve to get hacked, or if you can't do whatever the person's favorite security thing is, then you should just quit.
Like pick a lock.
Yeah, exactly. Or, there's another one going around saying, you know, you can't get started if you don't have full executive support, if you don't have a comprehensive security policy, blah, 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 blah. And all of those things are nice to have. Well, actually, they're great to have. But you can get started even if you don't have all those things.
Yeah, I agree. So the point is that a lot of people sit there and say, I often use the metaphor around corporate security or business security, IT security, as in a lot of the times it's like what you do at home. When you leave home, do you lock the doors? Do you close all the windows? Do you have an alarm system? Do you have vaults? Do you have alarm security guards patrolling when you leave? Whether you've got a security policy which is signed off by the CEO doesn't actually change the fact that you don't need armed security guards if you're not defending, you know, if you don't have the money for them or you're not defending something of value. You can start taking security steps by putting locks on the front doors and having keys for a start. A lot of IT security doesn't even have proper doors or locks.
Yeah, there's kind of another meme that goes around that, you know, security doesn't contribute to profitability in a lot of industries. It's certainly true that big companies that have compromises don't see the effect in their stock prices. But in the small to medium enterprise, you've got, you know, people have a responsibility to their employees to keep their employees from getting hacked while they're at work and getting their personal information compromised. And you've got a responsibility to keep the corporate bank accounts and other sensitive data and intellectual property from getting out to the bad guys.
So Jay, you were kind of making the point here that some people say if you can't even get started if you don't have all of these things, and so why bother? You know, and you could take that to another angle and say, we can't stop the bad guys, so we shouldn't even try. What's the point? And some security businesses are just saying, you're already compromised, you're already breached, we know this to be true, and here's our new product that's going to help you with that problem, et cetera. How do you react to that?
I actually think that they call that the assume breach mentality. And I actually think that's a good way to get started in the small to medium enterprise. Because you probably don't have the budget for a lot of really expensive controls, looking for bad guys in your network is a great way to get started, because it has both security payoffs and operational knowledge payoffs. If you are one of these people, which you probably are, who's split between security and some other job, going out and looking for bad guys in your network teaches you a lot about how your network works, and it puts you in the mindset of the bad guy and makes you think about what process do they have to go through in order to penetrate your network, find important data, and exfiltrate it from the network. And that has payoffs not just for security, but for your other day-to-day operational job as well.
So if I'm digging into the network, like you're suggesting, and I find a problem, I guess the tendency I've seen in some organizations is to freak out. What is that? What's the right way to handle that situation?
Well, what some people do is they freak out and they go on a vendor spending spree. That's not what we want to do. If you find a problem, it depends on what it is. You know, there's garden variety opportunistic malware, which is bad because that means that to some degree you've ceded control of your network to somebody who's not you. And then there's somebody's just exfiltrated everything. If somebody's just exfiltrated everything and you happen to be lucky enough to discover that, then you probably need to contact an outside incident response company and start dealing with it that way if you don't have an IR plan internally already. But if you find misconfigurations or garden variety malware, that kind of thing, then that's where you get to learn something new. But I would say what you don't want to do is freak out and go on a vendor spending spree and end up with a bunch of stuff on your shelf, having just blown your entire security budget for the next 5 years and not be ready to implement it.
So we just got through several points, Jay, about negativity in InfoSec world, kind of attitudes about people that are quote unquote stupid because they got hacked, you know, not bothering to do anything because it's just too hard, freaking out when something bad does happen. So those are all, you know, negative things about security. What do you think about compliance? It's another big thing. And there's a point that I can make about security, but about compliance, but I'm going to see if you want to make the same point. What are your thoughts there?
My point about compliance is I don't have experience with it, and so I don't feel qualified to talk about it in this context.
Okay, so we're not going to talk about compliance today, and that's fair enough, but I'll make this point having worked in a PCI DSS environment. This goes back some years, and PCI DSS has moved on since I was dealing with it, but what we learned from that experience is that just because you're compliant with a particular specification or regulation doesn't mean you're secure. It means you're compliant with a spec. Supposedly it will help you with being secure, but it does not mean that you are secure. Those are very two different mindsets, and it's very easy to fall into the trap. I passed the audit. Hooray, I'm compliant. And it doesn't mean everything's okay. So
coming back to my house metaphor again, just because, you know, when you leave your house, if you've locked all the doors and, you know, check the windows are shut, is your house actually secure? You might have a feeling that your house is secure, but anybody with a reasonably sized rock can chuck it through the window and get into your house, right?
Yeah. I mean, the thing about compliance is that it's a great thing if you approach it in the spirit of what it was intended to be, which is a checklist of things that are definitely going to reduce your risk if you implement them in the right way. But if you approach it as merely a list of boxes that you have to check and you're going to do the minimum necessary to check that list of boxes, then it's not going to reduce your risk to the same degree as if you approached it in the original spirit. Now, one thing I wanted to point out about all of this stuff that I just said is that in order to do any of the things that we're going to talk about from here on out, you do actually need to have permission to monitor and capture traffic on your network. So if you work in an environment where you're not supposed to do that, don't go do it because you'll probably get fired.
So but permission from who?
From whoever is in charge of your network. If you're a lower level IT employee and you want to start doing some of this monitoring stuff, you do need to get permission from management to monitor and capture traffic on your network. I don't think you need to get it. It depends on what your company requires in that sense. I just want to have a caveat out there that if you go and get in trouble for capturing the raw traffic of the CEO's email and you get in trouble, don't complain to me.
Oh, it's a really good point. I worked for a company that was against running proxy servers, because even though it would have made us substantially more secure, they said, we don't want to log or know what anyone's doing. We don't want to capture that. We don't want to have that at all. That's not our attitude towards our employees. We're not going to run proxy servers. We're not going to filter or limit what people can go to on the internet in any way. If people are going places they're not supposed to go to, that's between them and their manager, and that's how we want to have it handled. We don't want any of that stuff on file, which blew me away. It's like, this is bad on 12 levels, but that was the official corporate policy. It was a business decision, not a technical one at that point.
Well, I think you can have, you know, good security monitoring while respecting employee privacy. And of course, I certainly want to work in an environment where that's the case. So I certainly don't think that you need to be a law enforcement officer working in network security monitoring.
We could go back and forth on that. Okay.
Yeah.
but we won't today.
Ethan raises an interesting point, though, that we can talk about security in a vacuum, but it's going to run into legal issues. It's going to run into compliance issues, and it's going to run into the culture of the corporation or even the culture of individual departments.
Mm. Absolutely. And that's something that, you know, you just have to figure out as you go along. And it goes back to, we're trying to do something that's better than something that's not as good. And we want to get started and figure it out as we go along rather than not do anything.
Yeah. So your philosophy, Jay, I mean, you want to do something. You want to, whatever the, as much as you can is, you want to do that.
Absolutely.
So, okay. So how do you start then?
So the three things I would look at are some intersection of A, what's easy, B, what's going to have the biggest effect for your particular environment, and C, what you can use for operations and security at the same time. So since you're probably, again, not a dedicated security person, let's look for things that are easy, have a big bang for the buck, and that you can leverage for your day-to-day network monitoring and operations. Then take that, use whatever successes you find to get more funding, more staff, et cetera. And sadly, a lot of times, if you do find bad guys in your network, that's a great way to get more funding and staff attention.
Yeah, that's my philosophy. You know, by all means, lock the doors and check the windows are shut and the iron's turned off. But basically, your job is to be prepared to react, and that's what you need to sell to businesses. And that's what I say to them is, look, you're never going to keep your house secure because anybody can lob a brick through the window. But what you need to be doing is ready to react. So what would you do if somebody got in and started to get around? What's your media strategy? What's your recovery strategy? How do you know what – how do you find out? I would spend half of my security time, you know, a very substantial part, at least half, working out how to recover from an event rather than preventing the event.
Absolutely. Now, that's hard. That's, yes. You know, developing an IR plan, I would say, is a little bit further down in or higher up on the difficulty level, but it's certainly important. Should we talk about some general principles and then get into specifics?
Yeah, Jay, I think we should. We've gotten into kind of what you want to talk about and some background about it, your philosophy of security. So let's get into some security principles here.
Okay, so some just general things. People and skills first, product second. Studying security is a great way to develop operational skill sets that cross all the different silos, whether it's server, network, application, etc. And it just makes you a better technical professional. So that, if nothing else, is a great way to do it, a great reason to do it. Second, in the small to medium enterprise, I think we should be looking for things that fulfill a dual role in operations and security. So how can you use security to enhance your network monitoring and vice versa? Third, I like to use and advocate an adversarial mindset when doing security. So there's a lot of different security models out there that have parallels in the military world, the insurance world, and so the emergency services world and so forth. I like to remember that the bad guys are actual humans who are out to do bad things for whatever reason. And thinking through trying to model their mindset is a great way to focus in on what they're going to try and figure out in your particular environment what you need to monitor in order to detect that. I want to credit the book Practical Network Security Monitoring by Richard Baitlick for some of this stuff. It's a great place to get started if you are interested in this. And he's also got some older books. That's kind of how I got interested in this topic, was reading The Tao of Network Security Monitoring by the same guy. And it's a great place to get started.
So that adversarial model there that I want to go back to, you remember the bad guys are humans is kind of the big idea there. And that's true even if what you're fighting is malware or a bot or, you know, some kind of automated code that's often doing its own thing. Some human with a goal wrote that code to do whatever it is that it's doing. Fair?
Exactly. One of the things that Richard Baylick talks about in Practical Network Security Monitoring is a definition of risk that I think is really important to keep in mind. And he defines risk as threat times vulnerability times cost. A lot of times people throw around the word risk without having a sense of what it means. And if you use that definition, I think it works really well, especially in the small to medium enterprise environment. Now, unfortunately, a lot of times we don't know what the threat is because we're in a small environment. We don't have specific detailed threat info like you might if you're working for, you know, General Electric or Lockheed Martin or somebody like that. But you might know something about the threats in your industry sector and reading the annual security reports by all the big companies, whether it's Cisco or Verizon or Checkpoint or Symantec or somebody else, is a great way to break down what types of threats are being seen in different industry sectors. Vulnerabilities can be categorized using the, you know, Rumsfeld phrasing as known knowns, unknown knowns, and unknown unknowns. The problem with vulnerabilities is that you can end up chasing your tail and thinking that the more vulnerabilities you find, the more secure you are. We want to focus on patching the big vulnerabilities that get hit the most often as quickly as possible. We'll talk about that a little bit later, hopefully. And then finally, risk equals threat times vulnerability times cost. What about cost? Well, costs tend to be both industry-specific and company-specific in terms of the cost of a compromise and the cost of implementing monitoring and controls.
Cost of the compromise, meaning how hard it is for the attacker to get at you?
Well, two things. One is, how much does it cost you to remediate the compromise? And B, how much does it cost the attacker to get at you? So there's two ways we can look at cost. One is in reducing our own costs for our security program and to reduce the costs of a potential compromise. And two, to try to increase the attacker's costs. Now, in the small to medium enterprise, we don't have access to law enforcement or usually anyway. So we can't directly increase the attacker costs, but we can make ourselves a slightly harder target. So maybe they'll go elsewhere.
That's called the zombie principle.
Yeah, the idea of a honeypot and you know, things where you're tying up their resources in some way, but not giving them any useful information.
Yeah, honeypots are something that is, again, higher on the difficulty level chain. I think they're really useful, but mainly what we want to do is, in the beginning at least, is try to increase our network situational awareness and make our network a generally harder target so that the bad guys are going to be looking at somebody else. Later on, maybe you could get into honeypots and that sort of thing.
So you don't have to outrun the bear. You just have to outrun somebody else who's running.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't talk about the bear. I talk about zombies. You just have to be faster than you'd have to be faster than the fastest zombie or faster than the slowest human. It could go either way.
So finally, one last principle I wanted to talk about is, I think you should always try free before commercial. That does not necessarily mean in lieu of commercial. That means before commercial. And the reason for that is that trying free products first teaches you the right questions to ask of vendors later. I've seen way too many situations where people jump into a vendor purchase process without understanding what questions they need to ask, and then they end up with spending a lot of money on the wrong product.
So in favor of this one. That is absolutely, and that applies not just to security monitoring, but also to network monitoring. Use the free tools first and then find out what's really bad about them. And so you go into a commercial purchase with experience and wisdom attached.
A lot of times the free stuff works just fine.
And or the commercial stuff is based on the free stuff. It just has a much better interface or better support as well.
Exactly.
Okay, so your principles, just going back and doing a quick review, people and skills before product. Look for security functions that can serve a dual purpose. Remember that the bad guys are humans, and so you can think from a human point of view. Risk equals threat times vulnerability times cost. And so when you're considering risk, you're considering all three of those variables. And then you can go free before commercial to evaluate products, learn to ask the right questions, and then move into the commercial space if you need to.
Exactly.
And then you mentioned those books by Richard Baylick, who, if you've never heard of him, his name is not spelled like you would pronounce it. So we'll try to remember to get some links in the show notes if you're interested in his books. He also writes quite a bit and is pretty well known on the internet and so on. Okay, so those would be Jay's security principles. Now let's move into, what would you call this, Jay? Operations? You know, the practical nuts and bolts, or...
Yeah, I just want to kind of throw out some things to think about in terms of things you can do relatively easily that will have a dual payoff in terms of network monitoring, operational day-to-day workflows, and security. So a big one that is a problem in every company is asset discovery and inventory. And there's... I don't really want to say a ton of stuff about this, but mainly just don't forget that whatever you're already using for asset inventory and discovery has dual applications for security. It's hard to do security when you don't have any idea what's out there, and probably the beginning of your security program is going to be figuring out what's out there. But if you've already got something, you know, like a SolarWinds product or a Microsoft SCCM or something like that, that... helps you with asset inventory and discovery, then use, by all means, leverage that for your security tool set as well.
All right, so we got to qualify asset here, because from a networking perspective, we tend to think of assets in terms of the lower layer stuff, switches and routers and those sorts of things. Is that all you mean by assets, or do you mean the many other things too? And I'm asking this because you mentioned SolarWinds, and then you mentioned Windows SCCM, which does a very different class of asset management.
I mean, all of the above. I mean, you know, one of the great things that you're going to learn as you start doing security is all the weird stuff that's on your network that you didn't know about. And if you have one of those tools that discovers endpoints and embedded devices and that sort of thing, then use that as part of your security processes. But, you know, use your network infrastructure management tools as well.
And how often do you want to refresh that? Because my guess is things change, and depending on the environment you're in, they can change quickly.
Well, I would say that since we're trying to make dual use things here in this part, you're going to leverage whatever you're already doing operationally for security. So I don't think you have to be constantly refreshing your asset inventory, but if you can, that's great. My main point is just to if you've already got an asset discovery and inventory system, start by looking there.
Now, okay, so what am I doing with that information? I've got an asset discovery database. There's a number of tools that could be helping me pull that data together. What do I do with that data?
Well, the big thing that you're going to do in the beginning is when you find interesting behavior on your network, and notice I didn't say bad, because it might not be bad. It might just be merely interesting. You can use that to figure out whether or not it's legit. So I can't count the number of times I've been looking at some type of network monitoring tool and thought, wow, that looks weird. I wonder what that is. And if that's already in a asset tracking database, it makes it a lot easier to figure out whether that traffic is known and legit or unknown and not legit. If it's not there, you got to go do some more low-level diagnostics and try to figure out what's going on.
Let's take an example here. You know, when you say this, I'm picturing in my mind, looking at I want to see what's out there on the port that I'm plugged into. I'm going to plug in Wireshark and just see. And then you just kind of get a look at all the different broadcasts and the different sort of traffic coming to and from your workstation. A few unknown unicasts that happen to pop across the wire now and again, and you just kind of digest all that and take that in. But that's really granular. I mean, can you back it out a level?
Sure. I mean, let's say that you see repeated HTTP beacon to some site out on the internet that looks strange. You know, it's got a funny URL.
And would I see this in Wireshark, or what tool are you thinking of where I might be seeing this?
Any of the tools that we're going to talk about later, you know, Security Onion would be the one of the things I would deploy.
IDS, something like that.
Yeah, an IDS system. And you want to know, is that legit? Well, if you look up that IP address or that host name and you discover that's the key system for the doors in the facilities building trying to update itself, well, that's probably legit.
Yep.
Whereas if you didn't have a database that told you that those IP addresses were related to the key system in the facilities building, then you'd have to go figure that out which is going to take a bunch of extra time.
So we probably parked too long on asset stuff right now. What's next?
Anything that you're already doing for configuration management and change tracking. You know, what? There's a vulnerability that's been out. It was announced. It's not really a vulnerability. There was an implant that was in the news recently for Cisco routers, where it was discovered that someone as yet unknown has been installing compromised versions of iOS with backdoors on various ISP routers around the world. And it's, you know, it's generally thought to be some kind of nation state actor. But what a lot of the internet chatter about this missed is that you had to have level 15 access to the Cisco router in order to install a compromised version of ROM monitor before they installed the compromised iOS version. So if you were doing configuration management, change tracking, normal network monitoring to detect reboots and that sort of thing, you would have stood a better chance of detecting that sort of thing, although going against nation state actors, probably not. But the point is to say that there's certain classes of compromise of network gear that you are going to detect through configuration management, change tracking, monitoring for reboots, that sort of thing that you might not detect otherwise.
And again, going back to that dual purpose stuff, you're using this for configuration management, but it is also a security tool as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Another good example would be years and years ago, I heard about a compromise at an ISP where an attacker had used legitimate credentials to a router to change the configuration to redirect traffic through a GRE tunnel to some place where it could be monitored. And that was, you know, done right in the light of day by configuring the router. And because that particular small ISP wasn't doing change tracking, it took them a while to figure it out.
Now, the problem here, of course, is that when you start implementing those sorts of tools from a security perspective, but they're also tightly related to operational issues. So that is, operationally, if somebody changes a configuration and nobody's watching for the change, you know, maybe they're configuring the change as part of a day-to-day thing. Maybe you've got to have login, so you've got to have authentication, but who's then watching the people who've been given accounts? And the challenge where security, one of the biggest challenges of security is, how do you run it every single day? How do you operate security when the actual network itself is changing? So if you're adding and deleting users from, say, a Radius server, who's watching, who's deleting them? You know, when an employee leaves, then they've got credentials. Are you actually removing them? Because
absolutely,
I've seen plenty, you know, plenty of companies who haven't. But that's the hard part about this, is once you implement these systems, you still got to go a step further to be able to make them active. So again, coming back to my home metaphor, it's one thing to go and put really top quality locks on your doors, but you still actually have to lock the doors when you leave the property to keep it secure.
Absolutely. And that this comes back to a great place to get started and to improve things as you move along. But so many times I've seen environments where this information isn't available at all. There's no logging of any type of change. There's no logging done of anything whatsoever. So that kind of gets us back to logging and NetFlow, which I think we talked about a little bit in the show I was on previously. Actually, we talked about logging a lot. Mm. One of the other things I would say that you should do sooner rather than later is start logging things and log as much as possible. And the point is to just get started, first of all. Go listen to show 192 for some ideas about tools to use. But whether you're using ElkStack or Greylog or Kiwi Syslog or a commercial tool, just get started. Then you have the logs and you can iterate on the process from there.
Again, well, just one question here first. I mean, you're talking about logging everything. You're not talking about reading every log entry. What you do with the data is very different from actually having the data in the first place.
The first step is to get the data. The second step is to digest it in a way that makes it usable without spending 24 hours a day reading logs.
More than 24 hours a day. Even a small environment can generate millions of records a day.
Oh, absolutely. But if you don't have the data at all, you can't do any analytics. So the first step is to get the data and iterate on a process from there. So what do you log? I would say start with infrastructure logs, routers, switches, etc., because it's relatively easy to configure. Then look at, in your particular environment, what's going to be the biggest bang for the buck. In a lot of places, it's probably going to be Windows logs, but Windows logs are hard. Oh. One tool that I love, I cannot recommend highly enough, is one that's not widely known outside the security community. It's called NXLog. There's a free version and a commercial version, and what it allows you to do is take any Windows log file and export it to to any one of a huge variety of targets in XML or JSON format. And it makes life so much easier than trying to deal with converting Windows event logs to syslog and so forth. You can just install this thing, tell it to export Windows logs to JSON, and then send that to ElkStack or Graylog or whatever. It's wonderful.
When you said Windows was hard from a logging perspective, I sighed because for me, it's less about the formatting because you can get by that stuff, right?
Yeah.
It's just the sheer volume and granularity of the logging events Windows will send you.
Yeah. Ugh. But it's so valuable. I mean, if you start logging Windows events and then doing some basic analytics on it, in 5 minutes, you're going to find crazy misconfigurations that you didn't know about, which gives you operational and security payoffs.
But it's so easy to misconfigure Windows.
Yes. <indeed. laughs>
like, for example, the defaults. Windows inherently isn't secure when it comes out of the box. It's not like you make a mistake and it becomes insecure. It comes insecure until you make it secure.
Yeah.
And that's the fundamental
challenge.
There's
certain flavors of Windows Server that have been tightened down quite a bit in Microsoft's defense. But yeah, I think your point still stands right.
If you beat up on the little kid for long enough, he finally starts to toughen up a bit maybe. But, you know... I don't know.
Two other areas that I see in the small to medium enterprise that get neglected a lot are VPN monitoring and firewall logging. I've seen a lot of people that don't keep firewall logs at all.
Really?
I think they're less valuable than a lot of security people believe, but they are still... You still should keep at least a short time window worth of firewall logs.
I've always been fascinated by firewall logs, especially perimeter firewall logs, because you get an education on what's coming at you.
Yeah.
You see the SQL injection attacks, you see the ping sweeps, you see, all kinds of things to get a sense of what IP blocks are, just randomly poking around out there. They're probably not targeted attacks, but your perimeter firewalls especially are fascinating to me. VPN stuff I found to be very useful for troubleshooting people's issues. I was logged into thus and so, this wasn't working, or I couldn't get connected, and you start digging through the logs and figure out what's failing, Ike phase one, phase two, or whatever it might be, and get some sense of what's breaking down.
It's also a big hole in most people's defenses in that it's a place where people, bad guys who have legitimate credentials can get into your network and it's really hard to detect. And it's also a place where you sometimes see brute force authentication attacks, people trying password guessing. And since most people don't have good VPN logs, it's hard to detect. Whereas if you just log your VPN authentication stuff and maybe do some basic correlation on it, you can detect stuff that otherwise you wouldn't have a chance of detecting.
And generally speaking, the logging is a function of turning it on and sending it to an appropriate service. It isn't more complex than that. It's just out of the gate, it's probably logging locally and rolls over quickly. And so you don't have a lot of useful data. So it is honestly a minimal effort to Jay, as you point out, to log everything. You just got to spend a little bit of time, get that backend server built and start shooting events to it.
Yeah.
Well, there's two things about logging that you need to be thinking of. Well, three. Well, maybe 100.
We can always do a follow-up show on logging again.
Well, we'll just point you back to it. I mean, the instant reaction I have when people start talking about logging is, A, the first rule is to delete it, because you cannot store it infinitely. The first mistake everybody makes is they think they have to keep the logs for years and years and years. 90 days is plenty. 6 months is far too much. But, work out a logging, how long are you going to keep them? So that's number one. Two, work out how you're going to get the logs from the devices to the logging server. That's not easy. And it shouldn't be in plain. It has to be in a separate network that's reliable. Because if somebody's DOSing your network, the logs have to come off separately. And the third one is, how are you going to consume the logs? That's like saying, I've got all of my notes from university in that suitcase over there, but they're no use to you unless they're all filed and ordered and you can search them up and get to the things that you want, right? You've got to be able to get into the logs and get them. Mostly these days we talk about using things like Logstash and Kibana and, those tool chains to actually analyze the logs to turn it into something meaningful, because otherwise you're just looking at a bunch of text going, going tail F, and then using some regex in a AUX or sed script and trying to get it. You've got to have tooling to make logs work.
Yeah, and you can get a long ways just by counting things. Again, show 192. Can we talk about NetFlow for a minute?
Yes, sure. Sir.
NetFlow is a great tool for both security and ops. The biggest reason I like NetFlow is that you don't have to put a probe everywhere that's going to take a raw packet stream or a span session or a tap and analyze it. NetFlow comes off your routers and switches, and so it gives you, again, both security and operational benefits for being able to troubleshoot your network and detect bad guys. The problem is there's not a lot of great free NetFlow tools out there. They're mostly commercial and they're mostly pretty expensive to get a good one. But if you want to start with free, which I always recommend, there's one called Flowbat that is probably the best, easiest, I should say, of the free tools. And it's one that not a lot of people have heard of.
Okay, so we're going again through things that you can do and things that have dual purpose in your operational environment. So we got asset discovery, configuration management, heavy duty on logging, dealing with NetFlow records. What else you got, Jay?
Patching. So this is something that everybody loves to hate, and I love to hate it too. The problem with patching is that you can spend 100% of your operational and security staff time working on patching. So to try to get a handle on this, what I recommend doing is automate as much as possible, and two, look at those commercial security reports that I mentioned earlier to prioritize what you patch first. So if you're reading Verizon or Cisco or Symantec or whoever, figure out what is actually getting exploited the most and prioritize patching those things first, then iterate on that. So every time a new report comes out, try to make sure that you're patching the stuff that gets attacked the most first. Does that mean that's all you should do? No. You should try to do as much as you can, but you don't have infinite amounts of time, so try to automate what you can and patch the most exploited software first.
And by automate, you're talking about automating the deployment of patches to systems that require them?
Absolutely.
Okay, so Puppet Chef, Windows SCCM.
Or turning on auto update. If you can't do any of those things, then turn on auto update on your client machines. Do what you can. Mm-hmm. One thing about those commercial security reports that is really interesting is that there's a big correlation between vulnerabilities that have Metasploit modules available for them and the frequency with which those vulnerabilities get exploited.
Metasploit, again, being a security framework tool you plug modules in to test for various vulnerabilities?
Actually, to exploit those vulnerabilities. So Metasploit is an exploit toolkit for attackers to use. And any vulnerability that has a Metasploit module available to make the exploit easy is one that is going to get hit more frequently. So take a look at your vulnerabilities, see if there's a Metasploit module available for them, and patch those things first.
Metasploit's like DevOps for security attackers, for bad guys.
Oh, yeah, I had the framework piece. I didn't realize it was used aggressively. For whatever reason, I was thinking it was used more for someone who's trying to validate what vulnerabilities their infrastructure has, which you could use it that way, I suppose. But
Oh, yeah, it's used by the good guys and the bad guys, but you see signatures of Metasploit attacks all the time if you do IDS.
Hmm. Metasploit doesn't kill people. People kill people. Maybe that's not going to work, but anyway.
All right, so we can patch. We'll add that to our list of dual functions and by giving it a security perspective. Now, I mentioned Wireshark before. I've done a lot of things with TCP dump and doing packet captures. How useful is that information? It was kind of a last resort for me, Jay, but what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that as part of your professional development, one of the things that you should be doing is learning how to use packet capture in every product that your company owns that supports it. So you never know when you're going to get into a situation where you need to go to a raw packet capture from some weird place in the network, either for operational or for security investigations. So if you learn what you have in your network, whether it's routers, switches, WAN optimization appliances, firewalls, anything that's got a packet capture function in it, learn how to use it in advance. And then you've got another monitoring and visibility tool that you can use. I don't think you should necessarily be using that as your first line of defense or your first line of investigation, but learn how to use it up front.
So I'll just add to that. My brain went in about six different directions. You were saying that as I was thinking about different memories. One of them is learning how to use it up front. I just want to emphasize really is important because it usually happens that all of a sudden you need to do a packet capture right now. And if it varies on the different devices, how you implement it, you want to know ahead of time how to get that done. Whether if it's on a switch and you got to just redirect packet out to a monitor port or a span port, or if it's on a Linux box, it'll be different than on a Windows machine, which will be different than on an ASA firewall and so on. And then there's all kinds of different techniques. You want to know right off the bat so that when you need to know how to do it, you've got that information handy. Because for whatever reason, it's like nothing's the same to when you're kicking off a packet capture.
Yeah, and one of the things that a lot of folks don't know is that I come from a mostly Cisco background. All of the new Cisco routers and switches have built-in packet capture functionality that does not require you to copy traffic out to a monitor port. You can do it on the box. It's awkward to use, which is a great reason to learn how to use it in advance.
But you should probably build a TAP network.
Yes.
If you can manage it, right? So let's just set some expectations. One of the mistakes that people use is they only use the tools they know, which is to use, and they see a packet capture tool in the router, and they think that's what they should use all the time. That's the poor man's packet capture. It's not the right tool for the job. It's just a hack tool that was kind of, oh, look, we could do that if we did this in the software. Let's give that to customers and add more bugs to the iOS feature, I call that. It's not something that you should use, because you can easily break the router, take your network down. You should never use it, in my opinion. You should have a TAP network of some sort. Now, whether you're using big switches, big TAP, or you're using physical TAPs and Gigamon style assets is kind of up to, you know, your type of approach. But you can build TAP networks very, very low cost. It's probably not something we should talk about here, Jay, unless you want to get into it. But, you know, don't use the span ports on switches. Don't use routers and packet capture on devices, because it blows up your network itself.
I disagree with that. I think in the small to medium enterprise that you can afford to use the built-in capturing tools in routers and switches for troubleshooting and special purpose packet capture. You don't want to use it full time for where you should have a TAP network built. But you know, a TAP network is a great thing to have, but for the small to medium enterprise, it's probably not something that you're going to get budgeted.
Yeah, the challenge with span ports, Greg, I would say, is not the span ports themselves. It's that there's not that many of them, and you run out of capacity very quickly to be pushing packet captures around the network.
This is a controversy in the security world, and there's a lot of people who say that TAPs are the only acceptable thing. There's other people who say that span ports are fine, and it's one of those sort of religious arguments that we could go on about all day. But I'm just going to say, if you've got it, learn how to use it, because you might need it ad hoc.
So I agree with Jay in the sense that for a small, medium enterprise, if your only tool's a hammer, then everything looks like a nail. So if your only tool is packet captures and span ports, then that's the only thing that you use. What I'm saying is a better tool, the best tool for the job, is to actually use physical network TAPs on the thing and start to capture the packets using an alternative.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's just the market space we're speaking to would find that somewhere from very to astonishingly expensive, reassuringly expensive when you start breaking down the cost.
Well, the thing is, I agree with you. In the past, using a Gigamon or, you know, that family of commercial products and then buying network taps and all that, they're not expensive. Those actual network taps are less than they're a few hundred bucks a piece now for a gigabit port, for copper gig, right? They're not expensive at all. And if you look at what Big Switch has done with their OpenFlow, you can actually build a really cheap one, like for like less than the cost of a switch, you can actually build a multi-port, you know, packet capture network quite cheaply indeed.
Yeah, the Big Switch stuff is fascinating. I think it's really cool. And Gigamon has got some small appliances now. I've used the low-end Gigamon appliances, and they're almost affordable, but it's definitely another layer of complication.
The Gigamon has got wonderful features, right? And they do all these amazing things to the packets. And that's taking it, to me, that's like taking it up the next level. The first step is you sort of, when it comes to packet capture, you do it in the router or you use a span port. The problems I have with doing it in the router is there's a very strong risk that you'll make a configuration mistake and the devices will pop themselves. You can overrun the CPU, you can exhaust the memory. Those features are often not well tested by the vendors, so they're very buggy. And you can often find that you're using a version code that just crashes when you run it. Span ports, I've seen people misconfigure it and feed the span ports back into the main ports or overload the app. Like they try and put 10 gig ports onto one 10 gig span port and then go, why are my packets missing? I mean, that's the obvious one. But, you know, there's so many different ways for a span port to fail in practical usage that'll give you false monitoring data, that it's really not useful to use span ports, right? So my advice is always to say, if you can manage it, go and get some sort of tap. How do you build a low-cost tap network? Physical taps are cheap, and Big Switch has come up with a way to adapt their open flow-based networking strategy to being a practical way of buying low-cost monitoring networks. And then if you need more than what Big Switch can give you, go and start looking at the Gigamon tool sets and its competitors. There's three other companies in that space that have that product as well. And then you'll understand why. But it's like, you know, poor man's startup midway and then rich man's solution. And then they're the three levels that you're looking at there.
I will say that I have crashed more routers configuring NetFlow. I've crashed a bunch of routers with NetFlow. I have never crashed a router with packet capture.
Yeah, let me just say something about NetFlow too. I am not a fan of NetFlow. I think that Cisco's NetFlow standard is proprietary. And by and large, I would rather use SFlow. And although SFlow doesn't quite have all the things about NetFlow, it does work on everybody's product. So build a solution around SFlow. And then if you have to support NetFlow because you've only got Cisco gear, then make sure that your flow capturing solution supports NetFlow as an option.
So, well, that's okay. So there's another topic. NetFlow is one of these things that is... the people talk about it being proprietary, and that's a complicated discussion because NetFlow v5 is a standard. NetFlow v9 is Cisco proprietary, but with an RFC.
Actually, NetFlow v5 is not a standard. It's published as an RFC, which is fundamentally
You may be right. It may be an informational RFC.
It's an RFC. It's not standards track. It's just there to everybody to say, this is the packet format. You have no rights to use it. And Cisco has not let the patents go. It's proprietary.
I'm not sure you're right about that, but anyway, IPFIX is certainly an IETF standard that is supported by most vendors and is based on Cisco NetFlow v9 with a bunch of extensions. And IPFIX is another thing I've got a ton of experience with, and we could almost do a whole show just on that.
All right, Katz, I'm going to herd you to the next point here. So, Jay, we're coming to the close of this section on operational tools that we can use as a dual purpose for security stuff. A quick review: asset discovery, configuration management, logging all the things. We just talked about NetFlow. We're rehashing that a bit. Patching and how to handle patching and get good information from that. And then learning how to packet capture. And then last but not least, you had mentioned in the notes here, process auditing.
Yeah, so process auditing is something I just have looked at in the Windows environment over the last year or so. And it's a tool that is hard to use, but really valuable for both security and ops. It's not something in the small to medium enterprise that I would deploy on a large scale at the top of my list, but it's a good thing to know about that a lot of people don't know about. And in the Microsoft world, it's a tool called Sysmon, which is free from Microsoft, that logs every new process execution and optionally every new network connection and the process that created it to a Windows event log. Done a bunch of testing with it. It does not seem to hit the box too hard. And when you're trying to troubleshoot something that's really bizarre and you'd like, you know, why is this obscure vertical market app creating this strange network connection, or why is it failing, or what happened with this change that caused this process to fail? It's incredibly valuable. And you can take that log and put it into Elk Stack and do searches based on the process tree that was created, based on the hash of the executable, all kinds of different things. And it's just something that a lot of people don't know about that I recommend that you learn about. Really valuable, also hard to deploy at scale. On the Linux side, there's something called AuditD, which is the same thing, but even harder to deploy at scale. But they're both worth knowing about because for those really low-level security or operational troubleshooting days, they can be extremely helpful.
All right. So we've talked about a lot of things here, kind of some perspectives that Jay has on security, some design principles. We talked about some operational stuff. Now we want to move into some specific products and controls that you can use in your small and medium business dealing with security. Jay, you make an interesting first point here that you might not need a fancy firewall, you say here in the notes. And, well, I thought a fancy firewall is better. I got to have UTM and all this kind of stuff, right? So what do you mean I might not need a fancy firewall?
Well, I think it's Greg who likes to say that firewalls are just routers that don't work right.
They don't work by default, right?
And So there's this big vendor buzzword.
Just let me just qualify that. Actually, they should just be routers, except most firewalls can't run a routing protocol.
Yeah. So an example of a security guy who is not a big firewall fan, so I'll just say that up front. Next generation firewall is the big hot new vendor buzzword to try to make you buy really expensive stuff. And there are some really cool features in these NGFWs, but you might not need them. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. What I would like to propose is that not be the first thing that you blow your budget on. A lot of the lower end firewall features are a lot cheaper and they work really well. What do you need? Firewalls need to do, basically, a network firewall at its core is designed to protect against a lot of attacks against weak TCP/IP stacks that had problems that were exhibited in the 90s. And we don't have a lot of those classic TCP/IP stack attacks that the original firewalls were designed to protect against in the modern world. So you still need a firewall to do NAT. You still need a firewall to keep track of TCP state. But cheap firewalls do a reasonably good job of that. I've used the iOS zone-based firewall a lot, and it works really well. As long as you don't try to do too much logging, that's a good way to blow up the router. I've used stateless ACLs and switches. Stateless ACLs are great if you don't need to track state because they function at the line rate of the switch.
And by state, you mean TCP state. You mean a little less literally ICMP and UDP state as well?
Yeah. So, a good example would be there's a lot of people who think that you need a stateful firewall in front of your DMZ server farm. You probably don't, because you're not going to say you can't come to my website based on some arbitrary, weird configuration parameter that you put into your fancy firewall. You want people to come to your website on port 80 or 443. You don't want people to hit your web server on other ports. So putting a stateless ACL and a switch in front of your web server is all you really need.
Yeah, what we're talking about there is a stateful firewall is a way to imply trust. Right. So because it's possible to hijack somebody's flow, so what a stateful firewall does is says this source to this destination is permitted. And if the application changes its port numbers as it goes, for my source port changes as I communicate with the web server, even though I'm connecting on port 80, my source port might change around from 6,000 to 10,000, say. Well, then once I've let the first one through, I need to track those port changes and let them happen. That's a stateful connection. And that's the only reason that you need it in real life. You can use static access lists to get exactly the same result.
Yeah. And so, one of the things, if you're running voice over IP protocols or, H323, things like that through a firewall, then you need these fancy state tracking mechanisms. Mm-hmm. For your basic internet to server access, you don't need that. For internal network-based restrictions, you may or may not need a stateful firewall. You may be able to get away just fine with access lists. And you put access lists on switches, as long as you don't log, they work great.
Yeah, I've always, on my internet routers, I always had an access list that would drop just about everything so that the firewalls weren't processing all the traffic from the internet. Because you know how, Ethan, you said you like to look at the logs on firewalls when they're connected to the internet? It's kind of like saying, there's some scary stuff going out on the internet. You know that. What's the point in finding that out? That's a given.
Oh, it was just always educational from my perspective. And yeah, I know what you mean about the perimeter router before the firewall doing some filtering. Yeah, you can say, I know that this device, this host that lives inside my DMZ is never going to need to see anything other than port 80 traffic. So I'm going to put an ACL way out on the router edge that doesn't let anything through but port 80. Then when it is port 80, it gets to the firewall, let the firewall do some inspection on it. And then if that's okay, then I'm going to actually pass it through to the firewall. But
I used to drop, one site I was at, I used to drop 30 megabits a second by just filtering port 135 through 139 Windows traffic.
And Jay, I wanted to bring up to your point about make sure you're not logging on routers or switches if there's a lot of traffic there. The whole point is a log event that causes a syslog to trigger is a control plane event that impacts the device's local CPU, because you don't do that in hardware, and therefore you can really tax the CPU on an edge router like that pretty quickly.
Yeah, and some security people are going to be freaking out right now saying you have to log this stuff. If you have to log this stuff, there are better ways to do it. One is with a flow-based technology, whether it's IPFix or NetFlow or SFlow, probably not, or a IDS, which we'll talk about in a few minutes here, that does connection state tracking. You can log all of that stuff without hitting the router's CPU. Also, some routers have mechanism to export logs without a control plane event by using IPFix log exports. So enough said.
Okay, so I might not need a fancy firewall, and you gave us some examples of some firewalls that, like iOS zone-based firewall that might be good enough in certain circumstances. So it's an issue of knowing what you're trying to defend against and putting the right product in place. But let's just say I got a lot of budget and I want to spend it on something really awesome and shiny. What would you recommend to me, Jay?
So this will be my maybe a controversial point, but I think if you've got a budget item some budget money burning a hole in your pocket and you don't have it yet, one place to blow that money is on a good malware blocking proxy server, because they do, especially one that can be tuned based on web reputation. They do a really good job of blocking garden variety known malware and logging information about those drops. It's just a great way to block the botnets and the banking trojans and the drive-bys and the things that are just really annoying and take up a lot of operational time once you start logging this stuff.
Now, the catch being, you said proxy server, meaning I need to use that proxy server within my organization, and operationally, my browsers have to be pointing through that proxy server.
Well, you can configure it in transparent mode using a variety of technologies, WCCP, or there's some that can do inline.
Where you're actually redirecting the outbound traffic to the proxy appliance.
Yeah, yeah. That's actually how I've always done it. I've only done a few installs with a explicitly configured proxy server. I've done it mostly using WCCP redirect.
Does seem to be a thing of the past, the old push out a Windows policy that configures everyone's Internet Explorer to point to this Microsoft Proxy 2.0. It really takes me back in time.
One place where I think that is a good idea is in your server farms, because your server farms should probably not be making unsolicited connections to the internet. They shouldn't be initiating connections to the internet except maybe to do updates or something like that. So you could configure an explicit proxy on your Windows server farm boxes to only allow them to get updates and drop and log all other outbound connections. And then if you see your server trying to go out to badguy.com, you know that you've gotten compromised.
Now, you mentioned a good malware blocking proxy server. You suggested that, you get a proxy server that's a good one. Are you willing to make any product recommendations?
I am a big fan of Cisco WSA. I have used three different vendor proxy servers. One of them was extremely expensive and crashed a lot. One of them was extremely expensive and didn't stop the bad guys. And the third one that I've used is Cisco WSA, which is also pretty expensive and does a really good job. What we have done in my previous job was we would use the web reputation scores on the WSA. We would tune those based on input from our IDS. And so we would watch the IDS, see what types of malicious traffic we were seeing, and then tune down the web reputation score until we got a pretty low volume of malicious traffic being registered on the IDS without a lot of user complaints saying, hey, you're blocking the site that I wanted to go to.
All this kind of implies that I've got my own premises and I'm putting traffic through something I own, from a network I own. What if I'm up in the cloud?
There's a couple different companies that offer cloud-based proxies. Don't have a lot of experience with those. One I have some experience with is the OpenDNS's DNS Black Hole Service. They do a great job of monitoring malicious traffic on the internet. And if you point your DNS recursive DNS traffic to them, they just black hole all the bad DNS names that they find and log it for you. And they have some great analytics in the cloud-based analytics that you can use as well.
They do. And there's even a home-oriented version of that service as well.
Yeah. The enterprise version is, again, fairly expensive. It's comparable to buying Cisco WSA on a per-user basis. But it's a a really nice tool with some great analytics.
Actually, it's a great way to start. I would buy the OpenDNS feature first as a commercial product and then buy the web proxy server second, because OpenDNS is easy to implement and get you quite
Yeah, that's a great point.
And then the web proxy, one of the tricks you could have with the web proxy, and the thing that a lot of people don't do, this is really heretical in the US, but you know when you build a WAN for your corporate network, just don't put a default route in there. Have no default route. So most people in their networks have a default route that points to the internet, and then all the traffic goes out, right? And that just means that all the traffic can get out of your network if there's rules in your firewall. The things that you want to get out, but also the stuff that you don't want to get out can get out as well. So the most secure networks that I've worked for have no default route. The only routes that sit in the routing table are for all internal IP addresses, and then you have a proxy server, and everybody has to go through the proxy server to get out. So nothing gets out that is not deliberately configured on a proxy server or some other gateway device. And so matching the logs to a service or a permission or a grant, that's a very high security approach. It's very resource intensive to be able to track everything out. But if you've got a proxy server, all your browsers send the traffic to the proxy then makes the request to the internet, traffic comes back. You don't need a default route if you're using a proxy.
Yeah, another thing I've seen people do, I've never done this myself, is to point the default to a IDS. And then so all the IDS traffic, and using the same principle that you've just described, all your default traffic ends up at the IDS and can be used for
analytics.
That's
a bit pricey. So yes. I'm talking about using the proxy server as an explicit proxy. You have to explicitly send it to it. And the problem with the IDS and the default route is that you've got to have enough capacity to you've got to be able to cope with all of that traffic, and that can be wow.
Yeah.
So Jay, we've mentioned this proxy server and kind of parked here for a while. What about IDS? I was going to say IPS, but I mean, does anybody really do IPS these days?
I don't know what other people are doing. I know vendors are still trying to sell it. I have seen too many foot shooting incidents to be comfortable with IPS myself.
And again, we're just talking about, for those of you who don't know the distinction between IDS and IPS, IDS, intrusion detection system, where you're looking for a traffic pattern of malicious traffic, and IPS, where you try to take some step to mitigate that traffic. And the problem has been historically false positives, where the appliance trips on something that in fact is legitimate traffic and impacts the environment in a negative way, which really sucks. And so most of the world seems to favor IDS. Tell me what's going on, but don't do anything about it. I'll make my own mitigation decision.
Yeah, and my feeling about IPS has always been that if you know that something is bad and you know you're vulnerable to it, then maybe you should fix that instead of installing a device to block it on the fly.
you just put a lot of developers on the hook to fix their crap. I don't think that's going to work out.
So IDS, I am an enormous fan of Security Onion. I think you've had Doug Burks, the Security Onion developer, on the show before.
We have. It goes way back, but something before show 100. I want to say show 89, but I'm guessing, to be honest. But yeah, we did, and he talked about Security Onion in detail.
And it's only gotten better since then. I would regularly do demos of Security Onion to vendors when they would come in, and they would say, "We don't have any customers who are doing stuff like this." And at least in the small enterprise space. And so Security Onion, just in a nutshell, is a point-and-click Linux distribution that gives you either Snort or Suricata as your signature-based IDS with a good free signature package, and Bro Network Security Monitor, which is like a data extractor for dozens of different protocols. So you plug it in, you turn it on, and you get signature-based IDS with a pretty good web-based event logging and event monitor, and you get a massive amount of logging data with respect to all of the different protocols that are running on your network. It requires a pretty beefy machine for traffic of any size, and it requires a tap or a span port, but it's absolutely phenomenal for intrusion detection and for operational troubleshooting. I guarantee that most small enterprise networks, in half an hour of looking at bro logs, you'll find some horrible misconfiguration in your environment that you didn't know about.
Security Onion goes back to show 95 for us, by the way. I said 89, I was wrong. It's actually 95, April 2012. And so like you said, it's come a long way since then.
So the downside on IDS has always been that it's noisy, and if you mistune it one way or the other, you're either going to get too much information or not enough to actually see anything. How do you walk that line?
What I would do is I would install Security Onion. You'll have to do some reading. You'll have to spend some time, but you turn off all of sort of the classic old school detection stuff that detects attacks that are not really common in the modern world. Leave on the malware-oriented signatures and start looking at those. When you find false positives, you got to do some tuning. Also, I would say spend some time looking through the bro logs and just doing counting. There's a security event monitor called ELSA built into Security Onion, which is a log analytics tool. And just by running the canned reports that Doug has set up in ELSA inside Security Onion, you can quickly find oddball misconfigurations that have both security and performance implications in your network. Can't recommend it enough. And there's also a lot of videos out there on YouTube that go over some of the basics of Security Onion. And Doug's company, Security Onion Solutions, has very reasonably priced training that takes you into the gory details.
So IDS, you're recommending Security Onion. And in fact, in the notes, you even have an exclamation point after it. So, okay. Anything else in that world?
I don't think you can buy IDS that is as good as Security Onion is for free, for any amount of money. So that's a big endorsement, but I'll stand by it.
I'm bitter and cynical about most IDS products, and they're not my first choice because I've had so many years of miserable experiences. It's that you've got to have one. It's like sometimes, but you want to avoid them for as long as possible if you can manage it.
All right, Jay, email is another big communications data stream that's going in and out of our networks. What would you recommend for that?
If you are already doing on-prem, there's a good chance that your on-prem email appliance already supports StartTLS, which is the opportunistic encryption protocol for SMTP. Basically, what it does is you put a public SSL TLS certificate on it, and it will try to encrypt SMTP sessions using TLS if it can. It's just a good way to get some free encryption for email, which historically has been in the clear. It's often not turned on by default, so just check it out, turn it on. It works great. Another big thing is that I recommend is don't punish or publicly embarrass employees who get phished. Phishing is a big problem. It's the source of a lot of compromises. And the reason it's a source of a lot of compromises is that it works. The bad guys are good at making convincing phishing emails. And eventually it's going to happen. But if you are nice to your employees and you train them a little bit, even just a little bit, about phishing avoidance, they will report phishing incidents to you. And you want them to do that so that you can respond to them and track them. You don't want them to get embarrassed because they got phished and never tell IT or security again that something happened, because then you've just given the bad guys another possible vector into your network.
But isn't it more satisfying to rate them for being security ignoramuses?
No, it's not. I mean, it's...
You do it your way and I'll do it mine.
My experience has been that they want to help, and they're really good once they know some of the basic ideas about how phishing works at reporting it. And it's a really nice thing to have in your employees, yeah, is people who actually report that stuff.
It's a training thing. And certain organizations I've been in, it's phishing training or anti-phishing training has been a big thing, because I worked for financial organizations where people were getting phished all the time. So yeah, I completely agree on that point.
I feel like you need to invest in like a third-party course, or is this something you could do on your own, just sort of brown bag it?
You know, I have never used a third-party course, what I've done is just sent sanitized samples to people and said, hey, and what I do is I send it to just managers to avoid spamming the whole company, and say, hey, if you could just I explain what's going on in the text of the email, and if you could have some time, if you could talk this over with your employees, that would be helpful. And you know, for the most part, it's been a great experience. You know, it's been a good way of building some rapport with people.
Positive versus negative reinforcement. That's maybe something security professionals want to look into.
The carrot, not the stick.
You seem to be quite enlightened as a security professional. Not the ones I've met.
How would you deal with VPN?
We talked about VPN a little bit earlier. I think a lot trying to get visibility into your VPN infrastructure is super important.
So there's many flavors of VPN. So what specific flavors are you talking about?
I'm talking about any tool that you use to give people that you have minimal control or visibility over access to your network, whether it's employees who are on the road, extranet, people, vendors, etc.
We mean remote access VPN like SSL VPN or IPsec VPN driven by a client as opposed to like B2B connections with permanent tunnels and that kind of thing?
I mean all of the above. Those are all like commonly exploited vectors that often have exploit vectors that have poor visibility. So pick whatever you are using in your infrastructure, whether it's an SSL VPN or IPsec or something else. Monitor it. If you can, for remote access VPNs, use two-factor authentication. I know that's not easy or cheap, but consider it if you can. And another thing that I really like is trying to offload functions that give people full network access to web-based reverse proxies. So instead of somebody giving somebody an AnyConnect SSL VPN that gives them puts them live on your network through a tunnel with some complicated access list configuration, put that application in a reverse proxy, whether it's a Citrix gateway or the tools that are built into various vendor firewalls. That just makes it easier to monitor and control and put a box around as opposed to things that put people live on your network.
What's your feeling on people connecting into the network from a, you know, a remote machine? Do you want to scan that machine before you allow them on the network, that kind of stuff?
My experience has been that that results in employees finding creative ways to evade your controls. It leads to people who are angry, and it leads to a lot of support calls.
Yeah, Citrix is your friend there. The only way you can really not have people getting it, and there's no way to actually reliably control that in my experience. You know, controlling the endpoints outside of the physical premises, controlling the endpoints inside your physical premises is hard too. Yeah. And that's why a lot of big companies move to Citrix and thin client, is because it means people can access it inside the company, outside the company, third parties can get controlled environment.
Because the only thing you're letting them get access to is KVM.
Is the keyboard, the video, the mouse. And so everything's controlled. It's expensive. It's hard to maintain. You have to headcount to keep Citrix running because thin clients are hard to run and expensive to run. But you know what? Running desktops littered all around the countryside is even more expensive. It's kind of that's been the success of Citrix, and rightly so. And it's you should sell it as a security, you know, securing their desktop inside the premises and outside. And that's really the only way. The VPN is, and by and large, IPsec VPNs become and SSL VPNs become redundant because then Citrix client just does an SSL as part of the Citrix thing, and it's all easily managed and secured.
Yeah, Citrix NetScaler also has pretty nice logging that you can use to figure out what people are doing when they're connected as well.
So, Jay, that brings us to the end of your lengthy list of products and controls, things to think about there. So you got one more point that I think is a great one to make, which is a professional development. What are you getting at there?
Well, what I'm thinking about is that learning about security is a great way to enhance your network chops overall. I'm always surprised at the number of IT professionals that don't understand how the two most common protocols on your network work under the hood, namely DNS and HTTP. And that's because they're often hidden by the application layer and the operating system layer. But having a low-level understanding of DNS and HTTP are things that are essential to doing security, and they're incredibly valuable for troubleshooting on the network side as well. I've spent a lot of time helping application folks troubleshoot HTTP and issues and found that either there was a web server problem or a web client problem, or there was a DNS problem that nobody bothered to look for.
I completely agree with exactly that. I've spent a lot of time with application developers looking at HTTP data streams to explain some behavior or another, and then, you know, tracking down, getting to the real root of the problem, as which usually starts with something's wrong with the network or something's wrong with the firewall. Like, no, not really. Let's look at what's really going on. And understanding at an application level, HTTP particularly, I would say, DNS I found to be less of a concern, but crops up from time to time as well.
I find all kinds of bizarre Microsoft DNS misconfigurations by looking at bro DNS logs.
Hmm.
It's just learning about DNS and HTTP in particular, and probably SSL TLS in the future, are going to be things that distinguish you from other network and security professionals, and are just great professional development all around.
Particularly when you get load balancers involved that are doing layer 7 header rewrites or that are acting on the HTTP stream in some way. Your knowledge of HTTP will never go to waste.
I sort of have this point. I think I've either written but not published an article saying that the days of TCP as a protocol mattering are going away. The protocol that matters going forward is HTTP. And even now they're talking about running HTTPS over UDP because it's faster than actually using TCP. We could have a show about that at some point. But you don't need to understand TCP now as much as you need to understand the whole concept of how the HTTP protocol functions as a stateless, RESTful API, and it has verbs and commands, whereas TCP is just a stream of data between two endpoints. So, yeah, I agree. The world is very much changing in that area.
Absolutely. And Greg, you know how I learned about HTTPS over UDP was by looking at IDS logs.
Yeah, okay, right. You start to see quick pop-up from Chrome clients.
Yep.
Yep. Yep.
So, Jay, I think Wireshark is a topic that's come up in the show a bit, and various ways that we've used it. Again, going back for me, it tends to be overkill, and it's like, oh gosh, we've gotten to the point where I have to use Wireshark to figure out this problem, and then I get depressed. And right now, I'm having shuddering recollections of looking at complex voice streams coming out of Microsoft Link and trying to make sense out of what the heck was going on. But anyway, what's your take on Wireshark?
I've sympathized with you 100%. It can be absolutely brutal, but it's also invaluable. I think anybody who's going to be a advanced level operations person in either security or networking has to be proficient at Wireshark. If you're going to be doing sales or design or something like that, no. But if you're going to be doing ops in either security or networking, you got to be good at it. I would throw in another plug for Bro Network Security Monitor, which we talked about earlier in the context of Security Onion. Sometimes I refer to Bro as having an alternative use as Wireshark +++, because you can extract a lot of data from it in a much easier to handle format than with Wireshark, but it's got a steep learning curve.
Well, we're at the 91-minute mark as I look at the recording, which is, if you've made it to the end this far, dear listener, our hats off to you. Wild applause. Give yourself a pat on the back. A 90-minute podcast on security. Woo! Jay, you put a lot of great material here together for us. How can folks follow you on the internet?
I am on Twitter as at San Juan Swan, and my blog has just moved to JaySwan, that's Jay Swan, at github.io.
JaySwan.github.io, of course, is HTTPS.
Correct.
Very good. And what's your role going to be at GitHub again? You said security engineer. Do you have an idea of what your day-to-day responsibilities are going to be?
Yeah, I will be on the security team working on specifically on network security monitoring. So a lot of the stuff that we've talked about here.
All right. And now let's go around the table one more time. Drew, thanks for joining us today. How can folks follow you?
You can find me on Twitter at Drew_CM. You can see my blogs at packetpushers.net. And of course, you can hear me and the rest of the gang on Network Break Podcast.
Mr. Farrow, who's being disrupted, how are you?
Disrupted, disruption, moving house, can't find anything. On my blog at ethereummind.com and on the Twitter is at ethereummind.
I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. EthanCBanks.com is my blog. And of course, this has been the Packet Pushers podcast. And thank you for listening to Packet Pushers today. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. And by the way, you too can blog with the Packet Pushers. Send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know that you're interested, and we'll get you set up. And hey, you should know that Packet Pushers has several different podcast channels these days, including the weekly and priority queue shows about network engineering, the Network Break with news, views, and analysis, and Data Knots with data center architecture and silo busting with me and Mr. Chris Wall. So hey, at Packet Pushers, we strive to deliver interesting, useful content about IT each and every month, and we hope you like what we're creating. Follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.